Welcome to the public examination of an academic dissertation. Today, we will have a public examination and discussion of a dissertation made by Francesca Brandolin. The title of the dissertation is Act for International Students, an Act-Based Group Intervention for Enhancing the Psychological Well-being of International Students. The opponent is Professor Jari Lahti from University of Helsinki. Welcome to University of Jyväskylä, Jari. Very good that you had possibility to come here and be the opponent. We are very happy for that. As the custos appointed by the Faculty of Education and Psychology, I declare this public examination opened. And first, we will hear the lecture by the candidate.
Thank you. Distinguished Castus, honored opponent, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Tervetuloa, benvenuti. Thank you for your presence today. I will begin by giving an introductory lecture to the public on the subject of my doctoral dissertation, which delves into a topic of great relevance in our globalized world, the psychological well-being of international university students. At its core, our research aimed to understand how we can better support the mental health and well-being of students who travel across borders to pursue higher education. These students face unique challenges that can impact their psychological health. Our research aimed to enhance specific skills that will help them navigate these challenges more effectively. To achieve this, we developed a group-based ACT intervention grounded in acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT. For those unfamiliar, ACT is an evidence-based approach that aims to foster psychological flexibility. Psychological flexibility is defined as the ability to contact the present moment, fully aware and consciously, to adapt change or persist in behavior according to personal values and what matters to oneself. Psychological inflexibility, the counterpart, is defined as the inability to persist or change behavior in the service of one's own values. In the three studies that form this dissertation, specific research hypotheses were investigated and discussed. At first, we examine potential predictors responsible for psychological distress among international university students. Second, we investigated the impact on symptoms of a brief group workshop delivered face-to-face, and we sought predictors of change in decreasing distress and acquired flexibility skills. Lastly, we delivered a similar intervention in video conference during the pandemic, and we were interested in verifying if the different delivery method would have a similar impact to that of a face-to-face intervention. Previous research conducted on international students has proven that their distress is even higher than those of domestic students. Admittedly so, moving abroad to study and adapting to a new cultural and academic environment, while losing touch with their social network and support system, aggravates the stress factors of these students. Moreover, the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated the symptoms of psychological distress amongst the student population. Here is a visual representation of some of the characteristics of our sample. Most of the participants were female university students. This disparity in participation is a well-known limitation of voluntary mental health interventions. We had a vastly heterogeneous sample with students which originated from nearly 40 different nationalities. We also had a large age range in our participants, with the majority of them being in the first half of their 20s. About a third of the participants were from the Faculty of Education and Psychology. Here you can see more clearly the different cultural subgroups of the participants. Most of the students who participated came from Asia, mostly out of curiosity about the Western or Nordic approach to well-being and mental health, as well as several students from different parts of Europe, mostly Central Europe, Baltics and UK, and Middle East, North and South America as well. Study 1 assessed the relationship between psychological distress and psychological flexibility skills among 103 international university students. In simpler terms, we wanted to see if students who struggle to adapt to change also experience higher levels of distress, stress, depression, and anxiety. The findings confirmed our hypothesis. We noticed that the lack of specific flexibility skills predicted different types of distress, and here you can observe a graphical representation. Four distinct psychological flexibility skills were associated with different dimensions of psychological distress, namely living a fulfilled life based on valued actions, being in the present moment and acting with awareness, having a non-judgmental attitude towards oneself, and non-reactivity, which is the ability of not being carried away by one's own thoughts and feelings. The results indicated that stress and depression could be reduced by engaging in meaningful actions based on personal values. Improving awareness skills, together with non-reacting and non-judging skills, may have an impact on anxiety. Interestingly, values did not play a role in predicting anxiety symptoms. On a practical note, when counseling international university students, attention should be put on value-based actions, present moment awareness, and acceptance skills. Enhancing these skills could prevent or decrease symptoms of stress, depression, and anxiety. Study 2 explored the effectiveness of our ACT group intervention when delivered face-to-face to 53 students. We were keen to understand if this workshop could generally alleviate symptoms of stress, depression, and anxiety. And the findings confirmed our hypothesis. The face-to-face workshop was effective, and we identified specific flexibility skills which predicted a decrease in different types of symptoms. The intervention presented as follows. Several students were interested in participating in a well-being workshop to improve their study life and mindfulness abilities. Conflict of schedule prevented some of them from participating. Between the fall of 2017 and the fall of 2017, 53 students received a face-to-face intervention. Then the pandemic hit, and we decided to keep offering support through video conference, and 48 students received the intervention through the spring of 2020 to the fall of 2021. Dropout rates were relatively low, respectively 10 and 11%. The face-to-face intervention was effective in reducing symptoms, and there was a decrease of over 30% in students reporting moderate or severe levels of depressive and anxiety symptoms after completing the workshops. Here is a graphical representation of the predictors of change in different distress symptoms. Findings corroborated that it is possible to influence these students' symptoms of stress, depression, and anxiety by giving them access to a brief ACT-based group intervention. Decreased in perceived stress was predicted by a stronger sense of avoidance of unpleasant thoughts, a judgmental attitude towards oneself, and lack of clarity in one's own values. Decrease in depression was mainly predicted by the ability of living a fulfilled life based on valued actions. And decrease in anxiety was predicted by the capacity of being present in the moment and acting with awareness. To sum up, these findings suggest that changes in certain psychological flexibility skills may predict changes in different kinds of discomfort. Study 3 mirrored the second study, but was conducted via video conference with 48 students, a switch that was mandated and became especially pertinent during the COVID-19 pandemic. The question here was, can video conference platforms offer the same therapeutic benefits as face-to-face interactions? The findings were encouraging. The video conference intervention showed comparable effects to the face-to-face intervention in decreasing symptoms and increasing psychological flexibility skills. Here is a quick representation of a protocol of the interventions. The students had two individual meetings with the coaches, one at the beginning, drafting a psychosocial assessment, and one at the end, to evaluate the experience in the workshop, followed by questionnaires and feedback. The intervention consisted of 5 group meetings. In each, it was represented a different process specific of acceptance and commitment therapy. The interventions were relatively similar, despite the different modality in the delivery, whether face-to-face or in video conference. During the pandemic, the students were encouraged to talk about their struggles and difficulties during the time of the pandemic. And the face COVID protocol was introduced as well. Mindfulness exercises were kept shorter in this latest version. In addition, in the first version of the interventions, the students received paper homework and email suggestions. During 2020, they were also granted access to an online platform where they could read and practice material in the week between each meeting. Here, it's possible to observe the changes from pre- to post-interventions are relatively similar in both workshops' delivery. There were no significant interactions effect, meaning that the two groups change in similar directions. The effect sizes indicated slightly larger effects in the face-to-face intervention. Similarly, psychological inflexibility showed a decrease in changes from pre to post in both intervention types. Correspondingly, there were no significant interaction effects and the effect sizes favored the face-to-face intervention slightly. Further, we analyzed the attendance to the session constituting the interventions and the association with symptoms and psychological inflexibility. In the face-to-face intervention groups, pre-to-post changes in stress and psychological inflexibility when completing 3-4 sessions was significantly smaller compared to when completing 5 sessions. In the video conference group, there wasn't such a strong difference, and the corresponding values were similar between attending 3-4 sessions or all of the 5 sessions. Overall, despite being conducted during arduous times and with limited support, The video conference intervention helped the students reduce their symptoms of psychological distress and increase in their flexibility skills. Many observed changes were equivalent to those obtained in the face-to-face workshop prior to the pandemic, corroborating the effectiveness of this digital and distance-delivered method. Students participating in the workshops reported a higher degree of satisfaction. They affirmed that the online group was an important source of coping skills. On a practical note, it is advisable to develop and further investigate psychological intervention delivered via video conference to further examine and the benefits and limits of online group interventions. Ultimately, both intervention groups showed comparable decreases in stress and psychological inflexibility, and increases in mindfulness and value-based skills. Specifically, a non-judgmental attitude and living a fulfilled life based on values actions. Interestingly, there were no difference in how much the symptom changed in different cultural subgroups, although this result should be interpreted carefully due to the low number of students. Lastly, our funding have proven the effectiveness and acceptability of video conferencing intervention to be comparable to that of face-to-face ACT interventions. The practical takeaways we sought from each study is that when counseling international university students, attention should be put on value-based actions, present moment awareness, and acceptance, including non-reactivity and non-judgment skills. It has been shown that changes in specific psychological flexibility skills may predict changes in different kinds of discomfort. Moreover, it is advisable to develop and further investigate psychological interventions delivered via video conference to further examine the benefits and limits of these interventions. In conclusion, our research underscores the potential of brief ACT-based intervention in significantly improving the well-being of international university students, regardless of the delivery method. Thank you for your attention. Honorable Professor, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, please present the comments that you see my dissertation as given grounds for.
Okay, thank you. Thank you once again for inviting me in this position to write my comments on the thesis of Francesca Prandolin. And as we heard, this is really important work, very important research in several ways. As you said, the ill-being and the mental ill-being, unfortunately, has increased not only actually during the last few years of the COVID pandemic, but also during at least a decade before that in the young people in Finland, and this we can see in several statistics, like in disability pensions due to mental health issues, unfortunately, and the other reason is obviously that exchange students and international students are especially vulnerable, as we heard in the lecture. This is an important work. And third reason might be that international students is being an international student and going to exchange and kind of traveling in the world is also been increasing during the last decades. So there's a 3x increase in the international students from the 2011 to the 2020s. So it's a growing issue in that sense also. And also the fourth issue is that we have interventions that we know are effective, and there are interventions that require a little bit more research, and then there are adaptations of interventions that require a little bit more research. So there are plenty of reasons why why this research is very valuable and very, very interesting and very important also. I do have a few comments on the work, however. Maybe we can sit down and look at them in a little bit more detailed way. So, if we start with the title,
mm-hmm.
How do you find the title of the thesis?
Right.
What kind of struck me was the act there. Do you think that people know what act is?
Probably they don't. If you're not familiar with acceptance and commitment therapy, I don't think you do. But also, I like this acronym for acceptance and commitment therapy because it gives a sense of action,
right.
A sense of intervention that is needed.
Right, yes. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Yes, I see. Yeah, I probably would have kind of explained what the act means in
right.
the title.
Okay.
But it's, I see your point there too. It's an interesting way. And I think it turns, you can translate the act in Finnish also pretty nicely.
Yeah. Is it ought in Finnish, right? Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm quite sure that Raimo had something to do with the translation.
Yes.
Okay, in the introduction, there were a few other acronyms also that I was kind of hoping to be
right.
explained, like MBSR and MBCT,
mm-hmm.
but those are just small, minor comments. But anyways, do pay attention to the acronyms.
To the acronyms, yes.
Understand that. Then I have one comment on the abstract. You say that workshops delivered by a video conference during the COVID-19 pandemic showed equivalent effects on symptoms and psychological flexibility skills as in the in-person delivered group intervention. How do you find this sentence?
Actually, we thought about that sentence for quite a while.
Okay.
When I talk about it, I think I would say more comparable effects because the effects are very similar, but they're not the same.
Yes.
So equivalent may not be the right word, but I think we were out of time to fix this when we noticed. So I would say comparable is a better use of word.
Yes, I definitely agree with that.
Yes.
What do you think is the problem in using words?
In using equivalent. Equivalent basically means exactly the same effect or the same numbers in statistics,
And this is actually something that we don't really test in statistics. We don't test the equivalence, but we test the difference.
Right,
It's a small difference.
It's a small difference, but it's important,
Okay. But glad to hear that we agree that.
Yeah, I would have used comparable, but it went to printing a bit too fast.
Right, right. Okay, and then in the introduction section, I found that you quite nicely and quite convincingly showed that ACT is an effective mental health intervention for various different stresses and mental disorders. Could you tell a little bit more on why your research was essential and why exactly this type of and exactly that what you did was
different.
Necessary and important?
Mm-hmm.
A little bit motivation on
all right. What you did. So basically the intervention that we conducted, there are already very few studies that address counseling with university students. So already based on that, there's very few research that does intervention and counseling on mental health with university students in general, and even less with international university students. So we were only able to find two previous studies that used ACT-based type of intervention with international students. And one, more specifically, I think it was Muto, 2008, 2011. So it was an intervention based on bibliotherapy. So it was about a bit of a standalone intervention, so more individual. And the other one was an overgroup intervention, which I think is very interesting, but also it was also very brief. So only two sessions. I think two sessions may be a tad small, and it was a pilot type of study, so only 8 students. However, the results were very encouraging. It's a bit of a small sample to be able to assess if the interventions were really effective. Or at least you would need larger samples to assess their effectiveness. So the study that we conducted, actually, it's only the third, to note, conducted with international students. And this specifically is only the first study conducted in Europe. So this is the first one that has been conducted in a European setting. I was able to find only a very, very old study done with CBT, but it was in the 90s, so we decided not to include it. Yeah.
Okay, very good. So partly it is because the international students may be a little bit different group.
Yes, it is.
Partly because you have ACT there as the intervention,
yeah.
and ACT in a way,
yeah.
That it's not just two sessions. So
yeah,
two
yeah.
Meetings, but,
in general, like as far as I noticed, research conducted with international students looks to their socio-economical background and even to symptoms, but they don't really do intervention. So we know a lot about this population, but to present, there is no research done with this type of population.
Okay, yes, I see. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So definitely a very important study. Even 3 or 4 or 5 studies at the end is not very much.
Yeah. We definitely need
more
larger studies.
Yes. Okay, let's focus a little bit on these two issues. So international students and then the ACT. But let's take the international students first. So why do you think that international students are especially important group to study the interventions,
mm-hmm.
and why do you think that, as you said in the lecture, the international students are especially vulnerable and they show higher levels
of
distress.
Distress
and anxiety and depression.
Right. So international students, I think, even as you said in your brief introduction, it's something that is constantly increasing. So, if I remember correctly, looking at OECD index, before 2010, there was like maybe 5 million students in Europe, almost 6, and now the numbers have almost doubled. So, more and more students are going abroad to seek higher education, whether for a longer period or for a more brief period, like exchange programs. And that adds to their curriculum, it adds to their education, it adds to their experience for sure, but it can also add to their distress quite a lot. If you think about moving abroad and you cut ties with everything that you've ever known and you lose your social support, you lose your system, your family support, and in general, like the environment that you always knew, and you move into a new country and you have to adapt to a new culture, new academic environment. So I was an international student myself when I started doing this. So I was doing my exchange during my master, and then I met with Paivi, which is my over supervisor, and afterwards with Raimo. They got me introduced to ACT, and it was a basic lecture. So I took a course. I knew nothing about ACT. And it was a very, very nice introduction. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. And this is something that I would like to do. Because I don't think that it is talked enough how the process of pursuing higher education is already difficult. And then if you add on the stressor of moving away, then it gets even more difficult. Because you have the stressor of studying, and maybe depends on cultural backgrounds, or depends also on how you are as a person, or maybe scholarship. You have a lot of pressure to perform well, and you are in an unfamiliar environment. So it is especially challenging, I think, to pursue all of that. So I could very much relate to this experience. And when I learned about ACT, it was so simple as a method, but also like so very profound. And even for me as a psychology student, so I was fifth year, so second year of my master, before I came here, no one told me that like the fact that I felt so alone, so out of place, very, very self-critical, which I still am, but much less than I used to be, it's normal. It's part of a process that you normally live through when you study in higher education. And maybe there is a different way that you can approach this. Yeah. So I think this is why international student population is especially interesting to research. Because you have a population that is important. If I think about Finland, you will need international forces probably more and more because you're such a small country. But there's not enough research and there's not enough support. It's already difficult to give support and counseling to domestic students. International students kind of fall into second place. So.
Okay. So if you think globally also, do you think mm-hmm. that the same? I mean, now you told that there are these kind of internal expectations, high expectations, that once I go abroad to study something, I need to do well.
Yeah.
And the other part would be the lack of social support.
Yes.
And social
yes.
networks and social isolation in,
yeah.
in a sense. Do you think that if you think globally, mm-hmm. the international studying, do you think there are other factors that might affect also the vulnerability
well,
and the distress levels?
Yeah. Well, cultural adaptation
mm-hmm.
might be one of those.
Yeah.
Even if I'm European, Italian, Finland is radically different.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an adaptation
yeah.
to do.
Yeah.
And if I think about, I think even as it showed in our sample, most of our students came from Asia. There's a lot of people of students coming from Asia, from Asian countries. And when they move to Western type of perspective and environment, it's radically different for them. And I think it's very difficult to adapt for them. They tend also to keep quite close community, some at least, and some can blend in a bit more. But I'm also thinking about the economical factors, because it was also the same thing for me. Your economical status may depend on a scholarship, so you need to perform well. Which is, for example, if I take Finland in consideration, it's a difficult thing because Finnish people or Finnish professors are not so attached to grades. Other people need it. So you need the 5 in a 1-5, because otherwise you may lose money. Hmm? Or if I think about Asian, maybe a little bit of a cultural stereotype, but they are, you know, asked to achieve more and more. So it's either the top grade or no grade. So it's a lot to process, especially if you come in into an environment where grades are not as important, as long as you retain content and you get well educated. But if you have to have, like, you know, money, maybe your family expectation, maybe your own expectation, it's something that you need to consider.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Yes, I think it's very important when you kind of consider an intervention to think of the factors that make the target group
yeah.
vulnerable or make them suffer from the mental issues, so which are the factors that play a role there behind
mm-hmm.
the compromised mental health. And you nicely presented
yeah.
many of those, that the expectations either
internally
or externally,
yeah.
and the cultural adaptation
mm-hmm.
and the cultural differences, as well as the the social support and lack of social support and isolation. I think those are, they sound like a very, very important factors to me. Now that you think of ACT then as an intervention, how does ACT kind of focus on these three
type factors?
Yes.
So the cultural, the economical, and the support.
Social. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So if I think about ACT, and we think about, well, economical, you cannot do much because it depends on what is your source of income. If I think about social, and if I think about support, what I thought that it was radically different when I think about ACT, it is a transdiagnostic type of approach. So the fact that it is an evidence-based and process-based therapy gives you a lot of possibility to act on different type of distress, even at the same time. And if I think again of like, so the aim of ACT is to foster this psychological flexibility. So the ability to adapt to change, the ability to rise to challenges and respond better, because the important part in ACT is the way you react to stress and difficulties, not specifically the symptoms, which is very interesting and very different from other type of therapies. And I think also, in my opinion at least, what is one of the most important points in ACT is the value-based type of approach that you have. So values in an intervention like ACT are very important. If we think also about our studies, our primary outcome measures were stress, and the second one, clinically speaking, was depression. And those respond very well to values-based type of approach and therapeutic or enhancing skills type of intervention. So the idea of values, I think it's very specific to ACT. So the idea of you living a value-based life. So life has its ups and downs, but to live a more meaningful and fulfilling life, you need to act based on those values, on values that are yours, that are personal, and that matters to you. And I don't think I've seen this in other type of therapies. And students, if I think about applying this to students and international students in the specifics, I think it's important to remind them, okay, why did you move here? Why did you want to come here to studies? What is important for you to being here and right now? These are questions that I ask usually when I conduct a workshop as a coach. What is important to you? Like, what got you here? Because even in the worst possible moment, if you think about, okay, maybe there is a reason, hopefully a good one, that got you here. And if you connect to that, I think it's important to remind them.
So it's actually, if I get it right, the idea is that ACT is transdiagnostic and it focuses on the psychological flexibility, which then affects the burdens, the stress factors that lie there behind.
Yes.
So you don't really have to address each factor one by one when you focus on the psychological flexibility.
Yeah, exactly.
That then acts on all the different, all many different kinds.
Yeah. Even though in the workshop we tend to address one specific process during each meetings. So in maybe the first meeting, we focus more on values. Second meeting, we focus more on commitment. We tend to always like blend them in together because psychological flexibility is fostered by the totality of all these processes.
Okay. So how does it work in practice? Say that now that you mentioned that the economical side, you can't really kind of affect much. It is what it is. Obviously, you can change your view.
Expect
economically, but and lower standards if it's not possible, perhaps, or act on getting more income
Somewhere else, yeah.
But how about, for example, this social relations and mm-hmm. social isolation, social support?
Mm-hmm.
How would an act-based intervention influence
mm-hmm.
The lack of social support?
Yeah, so when we advertised the workshop, we were asking students, it's like, do you want to do better in your student life, basically, in your study life? Do you want to have a better well-being? Do you want to know a little bit more about mindfulness? We were not advertising this as a psychological intervention. We were advertising this as a well-being intervention. So very generic. And I think when it comes to the social part, the group aspect is very important. And this is also different from what our research group did with Finnish students. With Finnish students, this type of intervention, very similar in its protocol, is conducted individually with students. But those students usually have already their social circle, their support system in place. International students, when they come here, they don't. They have to construct a new one. So I think the group aspect is very important in this case. And it shows that the group has a good efficacy. So it makes you understand that you are not alone, that you're not the only one, that you may be feeling like distressed or uneasy and just difficult experiences in general. So the group aspect can help the social. In our groups, some people tended to stay friends, for example. I think there was also a couple that got together because they met in our group. So, you know, you get to know people and you talk about things and you share. And that's how, you know, friendship may come up or over things.
Okay, so it's not only about the content
mm-hmm.
of the intervention, but it is also how it is organized, whether it's face-to-face, whether it's online, whether it's group, whether it's individual.
Yes, indeed.
Group format would help in building social relations.
I think the group format is especially important for international students.
Right.
If you act one-on-one, maybe you still have good effectiveness, I'm sure, but I think the social circle is a big portion of that as well. Because the sharing, the pair discussion that we have in the protocol help people connect a lot deeper.
If there's research on that?
Not much. Not much. So we were looking for a group-based intervention and there isn't much.
Okay. No studies comparing the individual format versus the group format in exchange or international students?
In exchange and international students, no.
No.
Okay. Absolutely not. I'm thinking if there were any with over type of student population or over type of population, but nothing comes to mind at the moment.
Maybe an idea for the next
maybe
type of study.
Sure.
Okay. Very good. Very interesting. Okay. Yes. I find that commonly in Finland the feeling is that when you organize the group-based activities, it's a little bit more difficult to get domestic Finns to participate in the interventions compared to individual interventions.
Mm.
But perhaps it's the other way around with the international students.
It could be.
It
could be a little bit of a cultural difference.
Yeah.
I think it may be easier to get international students to do group rather than Finnish people. But it's a supposition, I'm not sure.
Mm. Yeah, but at least it sounds like the group format works
mm-hmm.
nicely with the international students.
Yes.
That's good. Okay, so let's go back a little bit to the content of the intervention and to the concept of psychological flexibility.
Yes.
That's an interesting concept. And you say on page 20 that the goal of ACT is psychological flexibility. And the that a little bit later on. You say that it is the ability to adapt to changing life circumstances, mm-hmm. which seems to fit very nicely with
international students.
International students. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned a concept of resilience.
Resilience, yeah.
How do you compare these two concepts?
So how do I compare resilience
yes,
to?
Yes. What's the difference? What are
to say to flexibility.
Yes, between psychological flexibility and resilience.
Mm-hmm. So I didn't do much research on resilience, but as far as I remember, resilience is like the ability to face difficulties. So how kind of well you deal with difficulties. Flexibility is a little bit different. It may be similar, or it may sound similar. Flexibility is a little bit different because it's like, yes, the ability to change and adapt, but also the ability to understand that if something goes wrong, it's part of a process of something. So if you think about the definition that also ACT or other type of third wave behavioral therapies have around the type of concept that they have around mental health. So mental health is placed on a continuum. You have ups and you have downs. In other type of approaches, or like when you think a little bit more about resilience, it's like, okay, this is a bad moment and it will pass. It's more like pathology, non-pathology in a way. And flexibility is like, okay, it will go down, it will go up, it will go down, it will go up. And, you know, it's up to you to enjoy both ways. I'm not saying that it's going to be easy. That's also a thing that I often say when I conduct workshops. I'm not saying that it's going to be easy, but life is inherently difficult. And it's up to you to make the most out of it. So I think this is where the difference between flexibility and resilience lies.
Very good. I sometimes just feel that we have in the field of psychology, we have those very, very close to each other concepts that it's sometimes very difficult to know the difference and get to understand the difference. And it's a bit confusing.
It is.
Sometimes. And also what I find a bit confusing sometimes is that you have these continuums,
mm-hmm.
you have, example, you have optimism
mm-hmm.
in one side,
and critical
pessimism
mm-hmm.
on the other side, and some say that it's one continuum from optimism to pessimism, whereas the others find mm-hmm. that it's not actually that
it's,
way,
yeah.
that there are different continuums, so you have more and less optimism than more and less pessimism,
mm-hmm.
but you can be
both
different
continuums. Mm-hmm.
So how do you find that in terms of psychological flexibility? Is it one continuum from
mm-hmm.
psychological flexibility on the other end and psychological inflexibility on the other end?
Mm. That's a good question. I think individually speaking, depends on personality. You may have a bit of rigidity still, or like lying into you. So I think, yeah, flexibility and inflexibility may sometimes fluctuate as well on a continuum. I think as you acquire more skills, that inflexibility gets to be less and less. So it's still there, and I think it depends on, you know, your learning history, your personal characteristic. I take myself as an example very, very often. I have a very self-critical attitude. I demand a lot from myself. And I'm not very easily satisfied. Sometimes I can also, like, let it down. This type of, like, at least the not-so-great consequences of it, or, like, when you suffer a lot more, when you acquire good skills in flexibility, it tends to happen less and less. Or at least that's how I see it.
So does the literature say that it is one continuum?
I actually haven't thought about this aspect. It's something that I could look more closely.
Okay. Yeah. I have a feeling that it's traditionally thought of as one condition.
Yes.
Continuing, but
yeah. So you have like both face of the coins.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think it's worth kind of thinking whether it could be the way that being high on say psychological flexibility could be different than mm-hmm. being low on psychological inflexibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, I agree on that aspect, yes.
Okay. Interesting. Right. So you told a little bit on how you choose acts as the content of the or the framework of the intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Should you have other possibilities or other sounded to me like you didn't really have much choice there, but
I would like to say that act chose me.
Yes,
I didn't choose act chose me.
Yeah. But if you had all the different interventions in the world in mm-hmm. your kind of toolbox, would you have chosen otherwise, or would you have chosen act?
It's an interesting question, and I have very basic background in other type of clinical intervention. So I think at least I would stay in the third wave of behavioral intervention or in, you know, contextual type of therapies. Personally, and this is also like based on what I did more recently, so I also took some training in functional analytic psychotherapy. I think it may add some interesting aspect to the ACT intervention. It has the tendency and it has the need by the core of FAP to be a lot more personal. So this may not be as effective or like as reliable or easy to use for group and generic enhancing skill type of workshop. But I would use some aspect from FAP, for example. Especially when we tend to talk a lot more about self-compassion, which is not originally in the exaflex, so in the core processes that are proper of ACT, fostering psychological flexibility. But I think it's an important aspect to bring up, especially when you introduce the concept of acceptance. So why is it important? Like, you know, to treat yourself kindly, to be open to your own suffering. So I would like to implement some part of that. You, in that case, if you do something like that, it has the tendency to go more on the therapeutical side. So it's not as generic or basic, in a way, as an enhancing skill workshop would be.
Okay. Very good. Yes. One part, one reason why I was asking this was that mm-hmm. you mentioned on page 32 that this was a pilot study.
Yes.
And that made me think whether there is a larger study or a new study mm-hmm. Underway.
Mm-hmm.
And is there?
There are some studies that have been conducted with FAP, or there are different studies. I'm not sure if they are intervention or if they are, you know, cross-sectional studies that look at the specifics of self-compassion and how that specifics, like, you know, element of self-compassion can influence different type of distress.
Okay.
I have read something, not much, because I was mostly focused on this, but yeah.
I was perhaps more referring to, in your case.
Yeah.
Do you have other interventions going on, or are you kind of planning to
All right, so to do it me bigger? Personally, yes. Right now I don't have.
Okay.
But, you know, it took some years to deliver this intervention.
Yes.
I did some smaller adjustment to some of the sessions along the time.
Mm.
So when I talk about acceptance, I tend to imply a lot more about self-compassion than what I used to be to do.
Oh, very good.
Mm. Or personally, I'm recently started working with an autistic person, and I do life coach with him and his family. And self-compassion or functional analysis is very important when you work with autistic type of population.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes, I think it's always good to, from in transition from one study or from one intervention mm-hmm. to another one, to kind of think a moment of the different, all those different alternatives mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the lessons that you have learned from this project to concluded data collection of this project, and when you're thinking of the next one mm-hmm. and you're thinking of the intervention that you're going to deliver in the next project.
Yes.
What is what is the best one that I can
find? Now I can understand a lot more what you meant when you asked this question at the time to think and process. So when, for example, we did another pilot with the staff compass, so the university personnel, which is, you know, different from students, we applied a lot more about case formulation, a lot more about functional analysis, because it's a more a one-on-one type of intervention. You want to go a little bit more in depth. You still use the ACT processes, or at least I do, especially the values part. I think it's very important. But I did use a lot more of functional analysis or case conceptualization. And And recently, even more recently, there may be a small collaboration on with the University of Leeds in UK to do ACT for young workers. So people under 30 or under 35, it's still like in the process of deciding that. And they tended to use a more mindfulness-based type of protocol. And they just started a pilot using video conference, which is, you know, very nice and like interesting, and you can reach a lot more people without them having to come to an office or a university somewhere else. But mindfulness based, I think it's very difficult to retain on video conference or like online platforms with a generic population that doesn't know much about mindfulness. So if I will apply some changes, I would definitely pick up the values a lot more, or functional analysis a lot more. Yeah.
Sounds like case formulation also. Yes.
I don't know much about case formulation, but when I used it, it helps people to see, like, what type of antecedents did they have? So, like, where does their behavior come from? What is their behavioral type of aspect, or, like, problematic type of behavioral aspect? And what is the consequence? What are the consequences of this behavior? So it gives you, like, a straight line from before, now, after.
Yeah.
So you can see how you may want to adjust or do something differently.
Yeah. Sounds good. Yes. And exactly. And I find that quite seldom we do, when we develop a new intervention, we kind of manage to do it in a way that it's the best possible, mm-hmm. the most effective, the best one.
Yeah.
I guess we kind of approach the best one little by little by practice and mm-hmm. by studies
and by research. You need the experience on the ground, then you can make some adjustment.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Okay, good. So there is obviously a lot that you have learned and during the study and it's obvious that you know the ACT framework very well due to your work in the field. Then a few words about the research designs.
Mm-hmm.
Research design. As you know, there are very many different kinds of designs that you can apply in the intervention research. Tell me a little bit, or tell us a little bit about those. Which kind of designs are there?
Right.
Are there better mm-hmm. ones? Are there worse mm-hmm. ones?
Mm-hmm. So if we consider the type of intervention and studies that we did, they are defined as cross-sectional in the case of the first study, or like the intervention, we defined them as quasi-experimental. So if we think about research design, definitely an RCT, randomized controlled trial, type of intervention is more effective, is more significant, because in that way you have, in that case, you have a way to say, okay, you have a control group and you have an intervention group. If you do have that control group, which we didn't, then you are able to draw causal conclusion and say that the effect that you have had are specific to the type of intervention that you applied, which is what we lacked here because of problematics in the selection of students, in participation, or like in numbers of students interested in participating. So we could not form control groups. And I think it's also important, if you want to investigate this type of interventions further, to do follow-up type of measurements to see if the intervention retains its effects over time. We couldn't do that either, but I was discussing with Raimo the other day. It would be interesting to see if this type of intervention retained its effectiveness. Usually, ACT type or in general, mental health intervention have a good retainment over time. In the Finnish student case, our research group had follow-up measure that retain their effectiveness over 3 years. In other type of intervention, I think it was with depressive clients or with burnout, it was even up to 3 years. So like even very long in time. So I would like to see with follow-up measures if the intervention keeps its effect during time. And also it would be particularly interesting to look at that with exchange students. Because in international students, we also had exchange students in our population, which may have been here for one semester, may have been here for 1 year, and then they go back home. And usually when you go back home and you move back, you have this type of reverse culture shock when you go back to your own country and maybe you live with your parents or you go back to a different type, again, another type of study system, or you go back to the old type of academic system. So it would be interesting to see if those effects keep also facing this type of change. So, yeah. A backwards type of change.
Before they start their international exchange student study periods, when they are about to leave,
yeah.
They start from there and then study during their international period, mm-hmm. and then afterwards, so you have the baseline.
Yes,
and
yes.
That would be very interesting.
It would be very interesting to see the effects on reverse culture shock.
Mm.
So does the ACT model or like the flexibility skills keep even when you have that type of reverse culture shock?
Yes, yes.
That would be an interesting question to investigate.
Yes, so the follow-up is important. And then you mentioned about the RCT, randomized controlled trial design.
Mm-hmm.
And you focused on the control.
Control group. Yeah.
And the role of the control group, and what does it mean that there's a difference between the active group and the control group.
Yeah.
And this is the comparison that we want to make in that kind of design.
Yeah. So you can you can confirm that if you had any effect on the active group, then it's specific of the intervention.
Yeah. Then there's this randomization part.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they do that?
So randomization, it's to, in a way, ensure that you are... it's very difficult to phrase this right now. So you randomize to avoid selection bias. So in a way, if you randomize and like you don't know who's going to the active group or to the control group, you have no like bias or any type of influence over who gets what.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are there any other ways of reducing the selection bias?
I'm not sure.
Statistically.
example.
I'm not very good in statistics, so now I cannot think of any, but...
Okay. So, obviously you can always adjust, for example, of the third factors that you can...
You mean controlling variables.
Exactly.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Controlling different variables, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's very simple.
Doesn't
really kind of, in every case, work, but it's kind of a step towards that direction.
Yeah, if you didn't have the opportunity to do a randomized control trial,
Yes, not often we do have, but it requires special kind of a condition.
Yeah, when you start and you apply a protocol of intervention, you try to control some variables, but especially in social sciences, it's very difficult to do. If I think about this study, our studies specifically, the pandemic context, for example, was very difficult. We didn't have much ability to control those variables. So even if, face-to-face, I can even stress a little bit more, it's important if you do the homework week to week. It's important if you apply the exercises. In video conference, it's already more difficult. But if you think about the pandemic context, it was even more so because you didn't know what was going to happen day in, day out. And I think it showed in the effects of a dose response, for example, or of a session attendance. Because if the face-to-face intervention had a linear progression, so if you attended all the meetings, you had better outcomes, the same thing did not happen for the video conference intervention. And I think something happened in between those weeks. It may have been another lockdown. It may have been that someone they care about got sick. It may have been that they were just really waiting with the difficulty of it all. So if there isn't the same linear progression and linear outcome, I think it was based on the variables that we were not able to control due to the pandemic context.
Yes. I suppose that the difficulty is that there are so many different factors that that affect us all the time, and it's very difficult to kind of separate that this change is due to this factor instead of this factor. So what if you start measuring the anxiety or depression in a 3-month intervention study, you start measuring these factors in, say, April, you start intervention in April.
Yes,
And then you have 3 months of intervention or the follow-up, and it starts, ends in say, April, May, June,
July. Yeah.
And then you make the assessment in July.
Yes.
And students are...
different,
On vacation.
Yeah. It is a definitely an interesting point.
Yes.
We didn't have the time to run specific analysis on, not the time, we didn't have the opportunity to run very specific analysis or at least include it in the thesis. But when we were running analysis, we noticed at least a small difference, if not a larger one in some cases, when we did the intervention during the autumn, because we started September, October. And, if you're lucky, you still have good weather, you still have good sun. And then you go, especially if you're not familiar with the Finnish environment, you go towards total darkness.
Yes.
And that does have some effect.
Yes.
In spring, I can see much more an open attitude, eagerness to go, towards summer. And, light help.
Yeah.
Light helps, for example. Yeah.
That's kind of the other example, or the other part of the year when if you start your intervention in September, you have 3 months of follow-up, and you end it in December.
In December, January, yeah.
And it gets darker and darker all the time,
and so colder.
Yes. So this is why a control group is very important. That, you start the follow-up, you start the assessments at the same time, and you end the assessments at the same time. And if there's a difference between the changes during that follow-up period, then obviously it's at least because of the environment.
Yeah, it's not just because of the environment.
Exactly.
Yes. The difference were not much, or at least as far as I remember. So still the intervention retained good effectiveness even with these. If you think environmental is very drastic in between winter and spring, summer in Finland. So I think the intervention still retain good effectiveness, but at least personally, I could see a difference in the students. So yeah.
And what if you start in one group your follow-up before pandemic, and in the other group your follow-up during pandemic?
Yeah.
Does that make a difference?
Yeah. Actually, this happened to a colleague of ours. So he finished one follow-up just before the pandemic hit, and then he had to add to the sample during or just after the worst part of the pandemic. Mm. So that affected his research a little bit, for sure.
How about in your case?
In my case, I think the pandemic did influence, yes, did influence quite a bit.
Yes.
We did use the face COVID protocol, so from Russ Harris, and that has a good effectiveness on how you're able to deal with the pandemic in general. But specifically, if I think about clinical significance, we see that the symptoms did not decrease as much as we did in the face-to-face intervention prior to the pandemic. So there may be a reason why it was a very anxious time. It was for me as well. So for me, doing my work, for example, and like, you know, be the helper figure, really helped me a lot, even with my own personal distress. For those students, it may have been different. You know, pandemic was something completely new for everyone. So I think especially controlling the anxiety or the low mood when, for example, we had very, very serious lockdown even here in the student village in, I think it was 2021, just the beginning of 2021. So when international students started to come back a little bit, and we had very serious lockdown because as the students arrived, they had a huge party and the whole student village had to go on lockdown. We were not running the intervention specifically around that time, but we were selecting students. So I think that influenced also quite a bit.
Yeah, and I was thinking of the design where you have one group that started before pandemic and you had the intervention during the pre-pandemic.
Yes.
And then you have the video
Conference during the pandemic,
During the pandemic, and I kind of noticed from how you write in the thesis that you may have had a little bit of a struggle on how do I kind of phrase the comparison.
Yes. We were very careful because in the beginning we thought, okay, we can compare because the protocol is similar. But then the context is different. So because of the context, you cannot really speak about an actual comparison.
Because, so you spoke about the reference group.
Yeah, exactly. So we used the face-to-face intervention as a reference group.
Yes, which is perhaps not the kind of the traditional way of phrasing.
No, it's not. But I think it was even before we went to review with the third paper, which is the video conference intervention, even before that, I was discussing with Raimi and he made me thought, okay, but the context is different. So we need to completely change the way you phrased, like at least the intervention part. I was not happy to rewrite the paper, but it needed to be done. Yeah.
So have you had comments already on the third paper?
Actually, yes. I'm just waiting for a final confirmation on publication. So we went through two rounds of revision at this time. And they have to confirm if the second round is good. They already said it's granted for publication.
Okay. Very good. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very good. Yeah. Okay. So partly why I'm asking these questions is that, that there indeed are different designs to study the effectiveness and efficacy of psychosocial interventions and interventions in general. And you have one way of doing it, and there aren't many others also. And I find that it's very, very important to notice the the benefits of different designs,
yeah,
and also the limitations
of different designs.
Of the different,
yeah,
designs. None of them are perfect. You,
mm-hmm,
know, they all have their pros and cons.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. And it's kind of your duty to know what you're doing and what are the,
yeah,
limitations and what are the strengths. And if you have limitations,
yes,
to mention them and be careful on,
mm-hmm,
how you phrase your conclusions,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah.
And partly I think you have succeeded, but partly I would have myself,
mm,
phrased things a bit,
yeah,
differently. But,
yeah,
let's go into,
okay,
that a little bit,
yes,
later also. The other part why I'm bringing this topic up is that when you, in the introduction, when you kind of present results,
mm-hmm,
it would be nice as a reader to know the design of the effectiveness studies that,
mm-hmm,
you present in order to be able to evaluate the strength of the,
mm-hmm,
of the conclusions,
yeah,
of the earlier studies. And I would have liked you to open a little bit up about the most important earlier or prior research,
mm-hmm,
that you kind of consider the most similar to what you have been doing,
right,
in the introduction sector,
mm-hmm,
section.
So, yes.
It would have been nice when you kind of tell about the earlier studies on ACT and with the international students and without the international students,
mm-hmm,
and with the focus on anxiety, depression and stresses,
mm-hmm,
to tell a little bit more about the design and
right,
maybe kind of give a little bit more value, even a bit more space to those.
To the design.
Yes, and to do those, maybe you did it, but I just don't.
Mm-hmm.
I understand it based on what I read, that you would only say you would only present those research that you consider are the most the best one, that,
mm-hmm,
the most kind of
right,
best quality research that you think that this is the
mm-hmm,
the kind of the,
mm-hmm,
the message, because I find that quite often we already have a lot of research on many topics.
Yes.
And not all the research, not all the publications are as good.
Yes.
So if you kind of, if you write them down in the,
mm-hmm,
introduction in a way that we have this study showing this, and we have this study showing that, then we have this study showing this,
mm-hmm,
the reader thinks that they are equally good
in
terms of design.
Right.
Whereas one may be a lot better,
mm-hmm,
in terms of design than the other. And
okay,
if you don't kind of weight,
yes,
them in any way, it,
mm,
may be confusing to the reader because they're the,
mm-hmm,
research.
So give an opinion on what type of intervention is at least statistically or significantly better based on design.
Yeah, and
okay,
as a kind of when you're presenting research,
mm-hmm,
you could say, for example, that in this review of prior research,
okay,
I only selected papers that,
mm-hmm,
had, say, large sample size,
mm-hmm,
or this and this research design,
right,
or this and this kind,
mm-hmm,
of qualities that you think that are necessary for conducting good quality research.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could kind of study by study, if you only have two studies,
yeah,
you kind of tell.
Okay,
the,
so expand on the design, yes,
so
okay,
that the reader would know,
mm-hmm,
that not all the studies,
mm-hmm,
that you present are
right,
equally good in,
right,
terms of their
mm-hmm,
design quality.
Yeah, it's a good point to raise. I definitely didn't think about giving an opinion on research design because the research is so sparse in,
yes,
a way.
Yeah.
But yeah, if I think especially about the bibliotherapy intervention, it is definitely interesting, but I don't think it can be as effective as a type of active intervention, like it could be a group intervention,
yeah,
in that case.
Yeah.
So it is interesting still. And it's interesting, especially the culturally tailoring part that they did to that type of intervention, because the bibliotherapy study was conducted with Japanese students studying in the US. And they gave them a manual, basic manual of ACT, translated into Japanese and applied to Japanese kind of culture, which is an interesting thing. It's also very cultural specific, which in a study like ours, we could not do because we didn't know before selection and recruitment what type of students we were going to have. And also, if you talk specifically about international students, I think it's much more important or like much more context where these students are in at the moment. So like moving abroad to Finland, for example, rather than their own cultural aspects. Even if it is a little difficult, even challenging sometimes to apply the same kind of concept to someone who is from Asia, someone who's from Russia, someone who's from the US or maybe South America. It has a different type of retention. But if you apply it to the context where these students are in the here and now, so the present moment, so studying abroad in Finland, then I think it's not as important to do culturally tailored.
Okay, so going back to the design of your study, so we discussed a little bit about the RCTs and the importance of a control group and the follow up. Once again, if you could do whatever you want, and you would do everything again, the next study, for example, how would you change the design of the study? What would you do differently compared to what you did now?
So, for example, if I think about cost effectiveness or reaching out to a broader student population, so I would like to do what I do in part of the first assessment, so the psychosocial assessment. When I talk and explain about the intervention, I would like to conduct a class on that so I can reach to a bigger audience. Maybe a specific classroom, maybe even during orientation days, for example.
I was more kind of thinking of the research design.
I'm getting there. So like it would like be easier and in a way more cost effective to like do one main introductory meeting, and then when you recruit you focus on the assessment, psychosocial assessment. So that's one step, like saving time in a way, saving time and effort. And I think I would like to keep all of 5 meetings. I have been going back and forth if I wanted to do more time during the group meetings. It depends on groups, but I am Italian also, and we talk a lot. I have a tendency to go over time. It got better. I think if you start with 2 hours straight away, it may be a little bit much for people to keep the focus. So I think 90 minutes is a good base. Getting really skilled, I would like to do 60. So 60 minutes meetings, maybe just over. Because I think it's a good timing in like to keep an intervention running, to keep meetings running. And I would definitely do follow-up measures. I would try to do a randomized control trial, like if I could have the best case scenario. Best case scenario would be to have waiting list or a control group, an active group, maybe even 2. So like if we want to do a proper comparison between the face-to-face and video conference, so like having 3 groups, one that goes to control, one that goes to face-to-face, one that goes to video conference. And in there, you will be really able to see the causal conclusion in between the, you know, the different groups.
And how does the waiting list come into
Come into the design? So, well, you use it as a control group, yes, but you also, like, not exclude these students from the intervention. They're just going to get it a little bit later.
Right, exactly, yes. Okay. And situation with randomization. So you would
randomize. Yes, yes. So I would definitely randomize the students in between these, which is harder than it sounds, because like one we even had two big groups, but we didn't have the possibility to randomize because I could not do two groups during the same day. It was a lot. And or like even the time during the same day, it was not feasible for all the participants, or like to have them divide, for example, do a session on Wednesday, do a session on Thursday. Then I could not randomize because those students were not able to participate based on their schedule.
So what do you think is the most kind of a difficult part of the getting it actually done when you randomize the trial?
The recruitment part, and also like getting the your population, so like your sample, to be available for when you need them to be. I noticed that it's very difficult and when it comes to, especially to new students, because in their first year or in their first semester specifically, they have a lot of things to tackle. So I think to encourage that, and we did think about this with Raimo, if you could give them credits to participate to this type of intervention, maybe it would, you know, help them out to participate, to be able to attend and actually engage in this type of intervention.
Yeah. And maybe especially the waiting list group or the, the passive control group is the most difficult one.
It's the most difficult one, especially if I think about the intervention to be delivered over one semester. If I think about the autumn semester, like the time is really tight. These, some of these students go home in early December, mid-December. So like, so do we have the time to actually apply that type
So if you advertise
model?
The intervention to students in say, August, and then they reply to your advertisement, and then you say them that, well, sorry, in your case, you don't really start the intervention in September, but you get a chance to start it in early January, for example.
Yeah,
but before that, we just wait.
I think if we take on, if we take on, for example, master students, it might be easier because those students are here for about 2 years at least.
Yes. Yeah.
So it may be easier to do that.
Yeah. And this comes to the kind of the downside of the RCTs. That's that quite often the population that you get in the RCTs is selected in some way because I mean, it's not easy to find a control group that accepts the fact that they will not get the intervention months later, or they will not perhaps get it.
Either they accept it, they are available, or they don't drop out.
Exactly.
Because you may even have them, and then when you actually start the control group to deliver the intervention, how many of those students do you have left?
And this is, I find that this is the reason, or one of the reasons, why different designs are needed in the intervention research. Research that each design has their own strengths and difficulties, and the design that you have is that you accept all the students and
no to give everybody the same chance.
Yes, which is obviously it's very close to the natural situation that we have, so it's ecologically valid in that sense.
Yes,
the same kind of intervention that they would get anyways, and they that the group, you don't really select the group in any ways. Or there is no kind of selection by the design of the study that affects the different groups. Okay, very good. I think that we agree on the need of thinking the content of the intervention.
Yeah, now that I know a lot more, I would definitely look more closely to the design before starting. Yes.
Okay, very good. Okay. And happy to hear that you have definitely kind of focused on the earlier literature, and you know that the concepts, and you know that the earlier studies, and this is very, very important. Then a few issues this is a long kind of introduction to the methods section where we can go next, but I think it was really definitely important to kind of set the background of the discussion during the methods section. So So you and one actually that factor that we didn't really discuss that much during the kind of the dream intervention study that we discussed about was the sample size.
Right.
That's which what is the kind of good enough sample size? Mm-hmm. And I was wondering now that you have a sample of 47 in face-to-face intervention and 43 in the online intervention sample at the end of the intervention, did you calculate the kind of the expected effect size?
Yeah, we did.
Did you do the power
calculation? We did the power analysis in the beginning. And we know that when, especially if you plan to do regression analysis, for example, having above 50 would be best to have better power, above 50 participants.
Okay.
So we were aware of that. Mm. Although if we wanted to finish up, then we kind of had to wrap it up. And that's also why we decided not to apply regression analysis in the third paper. We already had a lot to say, and like the number 43 was a bit low to apply proper regression analysis. So we decided not to.
Okay. Right. Mm-hmm.
So above 50 would be nice. Above 100 would be best.
Right. Right.
So yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And obviously it's always a kind of a balance that's that if you just continue collecting more samples, kind of. Adding more data, you will end up with a larger sample size, but it takes more time.
Yeah, it does.
And you have to start at some point, stop at some point. Yes, and the other thing about the methods that I was thinking of was the similarity of the face-to-face intervention and the online intervention. You mentioned earlier also about this phase called protocol.
Yes.
What's that? And where that
so the phase COVID protocol, it's grounded in ACT, and it was specifically constructed during the first pandemic wave. So it is specific to different skills of ACT. So for example, the focusing, coming back into your body, and the last one was disinfect and distance, so like the practical things that you can do even during the pandemic. So like how you can apply the processes specific of ACT for the pandemic context. So like how do you deal with the pandemic crisis applying ACT processes? And it's Russ Harris. Russ Harris is a very well-known author in the ACT community. And it has a way to deliver his research and also like his approaches and his knowledge effectively to a very basic population. So it's not much, it is grounded in research, yes, but it's not very scientifically spoken. So it can be applicable to general population. And the face COVID protocol after the first test run, I think it was picked up by NHS to be as effective intervention, standalone intervention for during the pandemic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So I was a bit struggling on that. So there are differences between the face-to-face, the other types of differences, rather than just the how you deliver the intervention, but also in the contents of the intervention.
In the content, not so much. Just very slightly adjustment that we made. And it's also because we were basically ready to start another in-person group. And then the university decided, okay, it's lockdown. No more people at the university, no more nothing. So we already promised a group intervention to these people. And we were like, okay, what do we do now? And we had to very quickly adjust the intervention to be delivered on video conference. We used Zoom. So on Zoom platform, things change because those students are usually in their home, most likely in their home, especially during the lockdown portion of COVID, and they are by themselves. So they don't have much contact. So those type of exercises that were, more interactive. I had to readjust. The mindfulness exercises, I had to readjust because we had a couple that were quite longish, so like around 10 minutes. We brought them down to 5 or less. Because just the environment or even the context was not that much favorable to that much mindfulness exercises.
Right. Mm-hmm. So how much do you think that there were these other factors also in terms of the
They definitely influenced the intervention, yes. Okay. So
how do you know then if you're going to have the reference group that is not only kind of delivered differently face to face, but it's also in terms of the content if it's different to the online group.
Of course, it is a difficult question because we only had so much that we could study and apply, but the protocol stands. So, like, the structure was fairly the same. Yes, the mindfulness part is probably the part that we had to adjust the most, but we kept the engagement pretty much the same. We kept the peer discussion, for example, even if they were online. I found a different way to apply self-compassion, even if it wasn't, like, as, you know, interactive as it happens. Like, there is this one exercise when you have to look another person directly in the eye. This exercise, you cannot do it online for an obvious reason. So I had to readjust. I found a video that explains a very similar process. So in a way, the structure and the processes are fairly the same. Of course, you have some changes. And yeah, that would be something that would need adjustment. Like, if I were to design, again, in the dream, best case scenario, I would use exactly the same things.
Yes,
that would make it easier to compare, to do a proper comparison.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good, and obviously, I mean, sometimes you just have to do, as you said, that you just can't do exactly the same, even though they're there. Idea of the exercise or the practice is the same, but if you're not face to face, you can't do exactly the same.
Yeah, you can do exactly the same thing. Yeah,
but the idea is the same, and this is probably one reason why also you could have chose to words the comparison as reference
yes.
group comparison instead of just the
just comparison.
Yes, I see. Okay, but good. And what is also very very important in addition to kind of being careful in the wording, how you kind of word things, to mention all these limitations at the end of the discussion in the limitations section, as you have quite well done.
A few
comments on there too.
Another one was like, for example, if I think about the mindfulness exercise, and these our American reviewer pointed that out. That when we did the mindfulness exercises online, we kept we give the option to the students to decide if they want to keep their camera on or off. And that, of course, may have influenced the engagement or like the people actually doing the exercise, because if they have their camera off, I cannot know what they're doing. So that definitely influenced engagement. It's not as nice because many people are not that comfortable with camera. But if I were to do this again, I would have the webcam on. Because in that case, and you can the retainment of of the exercise. Yeah.
And it might be more difficult for the participant to just
relax.
Yes, relax and then past
or even like many people tend to do eyes closed when you have a webcam. I notice that like many people open their eyes and like look around, okay, who's looking at me or like who's doing what. In the face-to-face intervention, in the group, in person, it doesn't happen as much.
Then a few words about the statistics. So in the study one, for example, when you at the associations between the symptoms, for example, and the psychological flexibility.
Yeah.
I noticed that you didn't really kind of adjust for any covariates.
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
So in study one, when we did this type of analysis using regression, we decided to use the linear model first. So the linear model, basically you have to put the variables in the order of which one was the strongest correlation. And then you get the model out, which one are the strongest predictors. Afterwards, we decided to use as a further confirmation the stepwise model of regression, and that models automatically select which are the stronger predictors. So the linear model and the stepwise model gave the same results. So it was like a back-to-back, because this paper was very difficult to get published. So we went through many, many rounds of revisions. And at that point, because some reviewers were asking for linear, some reviewers were asking for stepwise, some reviewers were asking for another thing. And at last, we decided to go for, okay, we do linear, and then we confirm linear with a stepwise.
Okay.
That was the way we decided to. But I make a note again that I'm not good when it comes to statistical analysis. So I had very much help in taking those type of decision and in conducting that type of analysis.
Matter much if you use the, the traditional enter type of regression.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't. But then the reviewers were conflicting on that. So
in the stepwise, it's just a way of reducing some of the independent variables that are actually not significant in the model.
Yeah, exactly.
So just kind of a step by step include. Variables in the model.
Yeah.
Okay. And in study two, then I find it interesting that you used structural equation modeling to calculate these within group changes from pre to post measurements, rather than just say
simple ANOVA,
for example.
Yeah.
So
we consulted the statistic expert about that.
Mm-hmm.
So which was the not easiest, but like the most reliable method that we could use, because our sample was already quite small. And then when we had post measurement, we went under 50. So like when we used the latent score model. Is that how it's called? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, structural equation modeling. Basically, the structural equation modeling helps you not to lose, in a way, everything that the people who didn't complete the post measurement or they didn't complete the intervention, you don't lose all the data, because the structural equation modeling basically counts mean values based on the pre-measurement and based on the other participant, so you can retain a little bit more data compared to ANOVA. If you use different type of analysis, then the people who didn't complete the post-measurement are going to be lost data.
Did you try to analyze it with the ANOVA?
I think we did, but it's been a while ago, so I don't remember.
I think I would be very surprised if the results differ at all, because, I mean, now that you only have two measurements...
Yes.
Structural equation modeling or some other type of analysis, they don't really have any more. If somebody is missing their follow-up data point there, they only have the first data point. You can't
right.
to create the second data point
right.
out of nowhere.
Yeah.
It would be different if you had several, if you had three or four or five data points there.
Then it's different.
It would definitely be better to use the SEMMOR or mixed models approach.
Yeah.
Data points. I find this is really, really kind of
A bit of a over
exactly
exaggeration. Yes, I understand.
Like
as far as I remember, and this was a while ago, so I'm really not sure.
Yeah.
But like the effect sizes were a little bit better when we use the structural equation model.
Okay.
So when we count the effect sizes, they were a bit more precise.
No argument on that. I think this is just like a kind of a shooting mosquito with a shotgun.
Yeah. We were overzealous.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it was because also another colleague of mine was using structural equation modeling.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, okay, we all use that now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, considering this point that how to kind of take as much into account as possible in the data, I find that when you say change 43, that's the analysis included all the participants who completed the pre-measurement n equals to 53.
Mm-hmm.
I find that a little bit kind of misleading in a way that's, I mean, you don't really kind of based on only the baseline measurement, you can't
mm-hmm.
really kind of, you don't really include in whatever measurement you have, you can include them in,
yeah.
in the model if they don't have any data in the later follow-ups.
Right.
I mean, you only have those who have the pre
and the post,
other,
yes.
Yeah, so you need to have at least one other data
point yeah.
there.
Yeah, okay.
Now that you only have two data points, the pre and post.
Right.
And if you're missing
if
the post,
you need at least a middle point or one follow-up.
Yeah.
Okay, I see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So actually, what you have is a sample size where you have those two data
mm-hmm.
points.
Mm-hmm.
So based on all the baseline measurements, you can include
yeah.
those who don't really have anything else. It doesn't really affect the results at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it has
it's a little bit more clear.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, then about the study 3, tell me about the latent change score model. It's an interesting statistical model,
yes.
I'm sure, but I'm not aware of that,
mm-hmm.
so how does it work?
In total honesty, I'm not sure either.
Okay.
So we used the statistical expert to
mm-hmm.
run this type of analysis because M+ is a very difficult program to work
mm-hmm.
with.
Okay.
Or at least it requires some expertise.
Yes.
So when we used this model, it was again not to lose data that we lost with the dropout from pre to post. So again, it like calculates a mean from the people who drop out, and you can kind of like estimate the value of those post measurement for those people, like on an average, if like the total sample changed this much, even the people who drop out may have possibly changed this much, or at least that's how I understood it. But I'm not a statistician, and I will not imply that I am, because maths is very difficult for me, especially statistics.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I would be quite surprised if this could really kind of impute in a way
mm-hmm.
that in the model where you have only two data points, if it could impute the second data point.
Right,
there.
Right.
I think it would do a lot of good if you have
different
say,
data points.
Data
I think Simone does, our colleague that is doing intervention with VR, he has many data points,
yes.
at least 4, if I
yes.
remember correctly.
Yeah.
So in that case, the model is yeah. much more useful.
Exactly. And in
mm-hmm.
that case, I mean, sometimes you miss the second data point and sometimes
yeah.
you miss the
yeah.
fourth data point.
Yeah,
sometimes
yeah. And that's exactly what happened to him. So
yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And there it becomes an advantage that you use a statistical method that can include all the data points there
mm-hmm.
and all the people there, all the participants, irrespective of which data point the
yes.
person is missing.
Yeah.
But in your case, you only
it
have
was
two
not
data
as
points.
Needed. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I agree.
Yes.
I agree.
I doubt that the selection of the statistics really have.
Mm-hmm. An impact or a different effect.
Yes,
yeah.
It affects at all.
Mm-hmm.
It may have some small, but I would be very, very surprised if we had
mm-hmm.
A statistical measure that could estimate the
mm-hmm.
reliably.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Of course, you can estimate.
Yes, of course.
If you use the other background factors, mm-hmm. if you use the gender, for example,
yes,
age,
yes,
and the country of origin,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, yeah. We did run some analysis on that, but we didn't include everything, because the number of students or like the different characteristics were so low that it's very difficult to do this type of calculation.
Yes.
We did this calculation with the cultural subgroups because it was required by one of the reviewers in the last paper. And it actually adds an interesting point that we don't see major difference at baselines with the cultural groups, but also not major difference in the change or like the effect that the intervention had on these different cultural subgroups.
Yeah.
Again, it refers to the context, I think. If you focus on the context that these students are in, so they're moving abroad to Finland to study, that you don't really need to do a cultural tailoring. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right. But once again, I'm sure that this is perfectly fine method, even though I'm not really kind of know it. But again, it seems to me like it's kind of a, it's like a, using a gun.
Yeah.
With a,
yeah.
Like a,
okay.
Cannon.
Okay. I will keep that in mind.
I'm sure that you have would have been kind of running a proper analysis with much more simple. Statistical analysis, but also what I find my advice in the future is that when you use a statistical method, try to
explore a lot more. Yes, so yes, I totally agree. I already like did a lot of work on the difficulties that I have with statistics. It's still not easy for me. I also have, like, not to just over-justify myself, but, like, I have dyscalculia. So when I look at big tables with big numbers, it's very difficult for me to select. So I need a lot of help in doing that type of analysis.
Right, yes. I'm sure that it's much easier to write an article and understand the results.
Yes.
When you know how the statistics
when you know how the model works. Yeah, 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 absolutely.
Yeah, so keep that in mind in the future.
Yeah.
At least spend some time with the statistician and ask.
I should. I definitely should.
What
yes.
What does this mean? And what's the model? And why is it this better than, say,
than this one? Yeah. Okay.
And
yes.
And let them explain you.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Just leave it there. Then.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
Analysis and this
we did
results.
Have a few meetings with Raimo, but the statistical expert is very busy at the department, so booking time is a challenge. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to the results then. I find the structure a little bit new to me that you have in the results section. You first have the results,
right.
And then you have the conclusions,
mm-hmm.
and also the key findings in the results section.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with this type of
structure? I was looking at over theses that my colleagues or over students have made in similar topics, and I kept fairly the same structure.
Okay.
So, yeah, I worked by example.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there are different structures.
Yeah, different ways of approaching that for sure.
Yes. Yes. To me, it's just like I feel that there is a kind of a repetition of some of the conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you first mentioned them.
Right.
In the results section, and then you kind of mention them again in the,
mm-hmm.
in the discussion section. I would have been just happy about just leaving them out from the results and mentioning them in the discussion. But it doesn't really hurt to have them there, but it just makes it a little bit
repeating.
Yes, repeating.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then at the study one, starting from page 47, for example.
Yes.
And this is a topic that kind of pops out here and there later on in the text. What do you think is the difference between association and prediction?
Mm-hmm. So association is a type of correlation where you cannot know what influences what.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Predictor is like, okay, we know that if you have a better level of this skill, then you may not have such strong symptoms. Yeah, at least that's how I understand. So correlation is a little bit more weak because you don't have causal or linear.
Yes, and mm-hmm. I would say that there's no kind of a temporal.
Yeah, temporal, yeah.
Connection.
Yes, yes, so as well.
With association, you mm-hmm. often have two coexisting
yeah.
Events
or yeah.
coexisting issues, and you don't really kind of say anything about the temporal mm-hmm. sequence of which comes first and which comes second.
Okay.
So which one are you, and this is, if you look at the mm-hmm. first so example, the dictionary,
yeah.
And what is the meaning of predicts?
Mm-hmm.
And for example, Merriam-Webster says that the meaning of predict is to declare or indicate in advance, especially for itself, on the basis of observation, experience, or scientific mm-hmm. reason. So it kind of includes the temporal sequence.
Okay.
One affects,
affects one the other.
Before one, something else.
Mm-hmm.
So right. Are you able to predict, or are you able to tell about the association?
I think in the first study is more about the association.
Exactly.
Yes. So the predict factor part is more in the second study when we have the temporal intervention part. So we have the 7 weeks from when they have the first assessment to when they have the last assessment after the individual meetings, group meetings, last feedback meeting.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Okay. Good. And and in quite often when you kind of explain your results, your mm-hmm. findings, you have this kind of could and may, which kind of saves your text.
Yes.
I mean, it's now when you're saying, for example, that instead, improving awareness skills together with non-reacting and non-judging skills may have an impact on anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And here, if you would have said that have an impact on anxiety, I would have said that you make an temporal prediction there and you say that this is how it is, that you first
right.
change your non-reacting and non-judging
yeah.
skills and they...
And then they affect
the
anxiety procedures. Display.
Yes.
Okay.
But you cannot. You have not studied the temporal sequence mm-hmm. when you study them both at the same time.
Right. Yes.
So you have studied the association.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you have to be very, very careful
mm-hmm.
Which words you use and sometimes. Sometimes in the discussion section, for example, I find that there's this kind of a smooth trend towards being a little bit more cautious in the results section
mm-hmm.
to less cautious
in the discussion, yes.
Of your conclusions in mm-hmm. the discussion section.
Right.
So, for example, you say that the data indicated that psychological flexibility skills have a significant impact on individual well-being and psychological distress
mm-hmm.
and can predict symptom display and changes in distress over the course mm-hmm. of an intervention.
Yeah, the language is definitely changing.
Yes.
Yes, that may be a point not as in favor.
Yes,
as you bring it up right now. Yes.
Yeah, I think you are making pretty strong conclusions based mm-hmm. on the correlational
right.
kind of
yeah.
Findings on the same
mm-hmm.
Time spot. So mm-hmm. if you would have two different time spots where you study the psychological flexibility skills, for example, now and their change, and then mm-hmm. you have a later time
mm-hmm.
spot where you.
Yeah,
that,
yeah, different different data point, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
you could say about the temporal sequence.
Yes.
But now that you're correlating them at the same time,
mm-hmm.
you're studying the association
yeah,
and
yeah.
not the prediction.
Right, yeah, I agree on that point now that you brought it up, yes.
So be careful on those.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, what quite often when somebody is reading the papers, for example, what happens is that they don't really read, or we don't really read the whole paper.
Yeah.
But we read, for example, the discussion, which they
yes.
read the conclusions
yes.
from there. And there, the person who is not reading the whole, that
the whole
know
paper,
about design,
yeah.
and doesn't know about the mm-hmm. analysis, he or she may really kind of be very misled about the
mm.
results. If,
right.
if you're not very careful in the discussion,
how you use the wording.
Yes.
Yeah.
What's the word? In,
mm-hmm.
And I would have used
different wording. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I see your point.
This is a little bit, you're making a little bit too strong conclusions
mm-hmm.
based on your design.
Yeah, based on that type of analysis. Yes. Okay.
And it actually, you had a very nice results in the second study about the changes in,
mm-hmm.
In the psychological flexibility skills and the changes in the symptoms. And there you might say that, well, we studied that both in two time points.
Yeah.
But as you studied the change
mm-hmm.
in two time points, you it could go temporally the other way around also. So it could go in the way that you study the changes in the symptoms
mm-hmm.
that affect the changes in the psychological.
In the sex flexibility.
Yes.
Right. Yes, it could be,
yes.
although I still stand by the ACT model. So the ACT model doesn't specifically research for symptoms.
Mm.
So we applied the symptom measures as a way to overlook the well-being of international students. When you apply ACT methodology, you don't look for a specific symptom, you look for the overall thing. So that's why this type of correlation was drawn.
Right. Yes.
Because yes, we used the symptoms to check the well-being, mostly because we changed well-being measurements during the different years. Because we had a different type of well-being measurements in the beginning, and it didn't have as good reliability. Then we changed to not lose the sample. We just kept the symptoms measure to research and to analyze for well-being. So that's one reason why. But when we used ACT, we don't look specifically for symptoms.
Yeah, yeah.
We look for transdiagnostic and for flexibility. Yeah.
And I think that you have a kind of a good theoretical background and
mm-hmm.
theoretical basis to expect that the direction of the changes go in the way that the psychological flexibility changes due to the intervention
mm-hmm.
and that changes the symptoms also, as you kind of phrase quite often
in
the discussion, but you haven't really tested that.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
So, well, I would be more
careful.
More careful in the wording. I think it's it is important, and it also kind of leaves room to say that in the discussion, in the limitations part of the discussion, that this is the limitation of this study.
Yeah.
You know, the limitations, you say that I can't say anything about the causal
mm-hmm. causal one, correlation. Yeah.
Yes, there's
mm-hmm.
one line there in the end of the discussion.
That's
very,
true.
Very end. So I was kind of expecting that line and that
to be more in the beginning and then at the end as well.
It comes
okay.
there, and it really was one of the last lines
yes.
there,
yes.
saying that I can't say anything about the causal relations. But then again. So I was kind of waiting for it a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Difference between the causality and the temporal sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we have a temporal sequence that something happens before something else, it doesn't really mean that there's a causal. Causality is
yeah.
even more
yes,
difficult
yes.
to
analyze.
Than
yeah,
temporal
yeah.
sequence.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you could show the causality, that would be really a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, no. Yeah, probably would. Yeah, yes. It is a definite limitation of like social sciences. Yeah.
So it would be good to also say in the limitations that based on this data, it's unfortunately not possible to
draw from a conclusion
about the mm-hmm. temporal sequence. Mm-hmm. We have theoretical basis to assume that it goes this and this and this way, but mm-hmm. we haven't really tested. We can't test it in this data set because we have collected the data at the same time point,
yes.
In the next study that I'm going to do, we will take this into account and do another type of study where we can study that. So
I probably would now, if I had the chance, yes.
And you have to, you can kind of use these different limitations that you have in the design to give kind of explanation of the need for the further or for the next type of research.
Yeah.
So you kind of use that as a, when you have the kind of storyline in your research, you can, the whole story that comes from lack of knowledge in some your results and your discussion. These kind of reasons why the further research is needed and use that in your
research. For sure.
Okay. So then about the results, see that the clock is ticking. then I was, when you were on, for example, on page 50, where you have different regression models that you present.
Yeah.
And you have multiple different independent variables. At some point, I was a bit confused on which variables did you have in the model. Sometimes you kind of mention that you were investigating something together with the FMQ and ELS, for example, so you were adjusting for these factors, you were controlling for these factors, whereas in some models you weren't really kind of very specific on what did you have in the model. And I think that that's also something that is quite important for the reader to understand that what factors did you have in the model.
Yes, I agree on that point. I think that this was like this graphical representation that we use and this type of wording that we used was a little bit more easier to understand the different predictors for the different type of symptoms. If you want to look more closely to the type of model, I think the table that is in the second article, like towards the end, is a little more clear on that. Because in that you can clearly see which one were the predictors tested. And for example, I remember that we divided from the total of the scale to the subscale to analyze the process more clearly.
Yeah.
So you had the totals and the subscales after, and then based on those, then you have a model which are more influential. So in that case, I think if you really want to understand which were the predictors that we tested, then you look at the table that is on Article 2.
Right. So. Yes. Yeah, so let's take, for example, figure 8 in the page 50.
Yes.
So how would you, what would you conclude based on this figure?
I think because in this case, we really wanted to take a closer look at the different processes. So if we look at figure 8, those are the dimension of psychological flexibility that can predict the change in stress. So specifically for that, value-based is very important. So life fulfillment, the fact that you are able to conduct a good life based on valued actions. So the amount of fulfillment based on values that you have in your current life at the moment. And that is very important when it comes to stress, I think. Because when you are stressed, you have this difficulty to like enjoy the things that you are doing. So that's one thing. You also tend to lose touch with awareness. So like when you have a lot to do, for example, stress rises up and you tend to run on autopilot. So when you apply awareness skill, acting with awareness, and it's like, okay, I am doing this for this reason. And like, I am in here in this moment, really like focusing on what I'm doing. For many things, like it can be when you're studying, it can be when you are commuting, it can be when you're cooking, for example, which may be very, very dangerous. Like, you know, you cut vegetables and then you cut a finger. Could happen. Happened to me too. And then the non-judgment part, I think it's also very important, because when you are like, especially if we think about the population, so the international students, it's very easy to have a critical attitude, a critical judgment towards yourself. Let's say when you have had a lot of assignments and you didn't get as good as a grade as you thought, as you expected, as you wanted. If you are already like running on high level of stress, then it's easy to say, oh, I am the worst. It's my fault. Not the assignment, not the context, not the environment. It's me. I'm the flawed one. So lessening that type of perspective can really help decrease distress.
Okay. Right. And how much?
How much? So let me see. If we talk about specifically about the non-judgment facet, so it adds about 3% to the whole.
And these three factors
altogether? Yes. Altogether, if I remember correctly, is about 40%. Almost 40%. 35. Yeah. 35. Yeah, sorry. Yes.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. So in the model, if we think of this kind of statistically in the model, you have these three factors that you use to explain the perceived stress. And altogether, they explain about 35% of the variance in the perceived stress. And the strongest factor is this life fulfillment. And the next one is this FFNQ, which is the acting with awareness.
Yeah.
And the third one is the non-judgment.
Yeah,
okay. And and now that you have this model where they all are in, you know the total effects, and you know about the kind of the effect of each of them in the context where they are all in the model.
Right.
And when you're kind of teasing apart one after one each process, other, you have to kind of keep in mind all the time that when you're talking about, for example, this non-judgment, which has the smallest effect on the association with the perceived stress, you are at the same time adjusting for the two
factors. Yes, I think it's like the adding factor that like the whole together works.
Exactly.
So like non-judgment add this much,
exactly,
but all together they work for this much.
Exactly.
Yes, yes.
So if you look only at the non-judgment without the two others, it probably has a lot bigger effect on the perceived.
It does. If you test it by itself, it does. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay. That's good. Good. And once again, this is just something that you need to realize when you're kind of writing down that what can I conclude from these models.
Yes. Yeah.
And be kind of specific. Different factors one by one, the conclusion is very different or can be very different compared to the
to apply more models for sure.
Yes, yeah. And this is somehow vague in as I said earlier, that what do you really kind of control for in different models?
Yes.
To be specific in that. and also what kind of surprised me a little bit was mm-hmm. that you didn't really control for the very typical possible confounding factors such as sex and age.
I think because we had such large difference, it was difficult to say, like, for example, gender or age. We had 80% were female, 20% were male, so the numbers were very low to be able to assess a proper difference based on that.
Okay.
Mm-mm. We did run analysis, if I remember correctly, but they were not significant or, like, good.
Okay, well...
Good enough to report, at least.
Yeah, now that they are not reported, I mean,
yeah.
We don't know, but...
Yes.
Quite often it's pretty typical that you're going to be in cold.
Yeah, at least with gender and age, yeah, yes. Yeah, I agree on that.
Yeah. And I'm very kind of surprised that none of the reviewers asked for those type of...
They, I guess they didn't because they knew that we were low in numbers.
Hmm. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, there are so many intervention studies with even smaller samples, like 30.
Yes, I saw that, yeah. So,
that low in number.
Yeah, that may be true. Yes. Yes, I agree on that point.
But I mean,
when we decided what to get in the many variables that we got, then we had to make a selection.
Mm.
So probably we did this for, like, the disparity reason.
Okay. And then in the study two, I was a bit surprised about the. I was a little bit confused about this completers and this continued.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that there are 11% of the participants discontinued
the intervention. Yeah.
So 6 out of 53.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say that about 83% of the participants attended 4 to 5 group meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of concluded myself that those are probably the completers of the...
Yeah, because basically, like, when we used analysis, so when we decided how to interpret if a student completed the intervention or not, the minimum amount of meetings to attend was 3.
Oh, yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so right, so
yes.
3 would be enough
exactly. It didn't happen much, but it did happen that we had someone attending the first meeting and then coming back for the fourth.
Okay. So
in that case, we still decided not to
include
it in the completion of the intervention.
Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, now I see. So I was just summing up this 11% and 83%.
Yeah.
It ended up like a...
No. Basically, it's like to say that still a good portion of them attended most meetings.
Right. So mm-hmm. 3 would be...
Yeah, 3 would be the minimum to be considered intervention completed.
Right.
Yeah.
I see. Okay, thank you. Okay. Then there were some cases where I would have liked to see some statistics in there, like in page 53, when you say that students attending all 5 workshop sessions
mm-hmm.
recorded larger improvements compared to students
who didn't,
3
mm-hmm.
or 4, which is nice, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but there's no statistics there, so it seems like you didn't test the difference.
Yeah, no, we did. We did. We didn't think about including numbers now that I can see it myself, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Then going to study 3.
Mm-hmm.
Right, then as in the lecture also, you mentioned about this interaction effects that you tested. So which type of, what kind of interactions did you test?
So basically we tested the fact that the groups had change in a similar direction.
Okay.
again, I had help from the statistic expert, so I'm really not sure about what type of interaction was tested. But we can confirm that, like, the change is similar in both groups.
Yes, right. Okay, so what you tested is this group by time interaction.
Group by time interaction, yeah.
So this is also because you may have many different kinds of interactions.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be good to tell the reader that which type of interaction did you really test there in the models. And this was definitely a group by time
interaction. Group by time interaction, okay.
And then there are some kind of vague sentences in there in the results section of study 3 also, like in page 59, where it says that although the groups did not change statistically differently from pre to post intervention, between and within groups, effect sizes indicated slightly larger positive changes in the face-to-face intervention.
Yes.
Group. Yes. I guess the groups actually did not change, but the symptoms changed. And then the other would be that I suppose you're referring to the difference between the groups.
The group effect size. Yes, yes.
Because you're reporting the change.
Yeah, from the change in symptoms. Yes, yes. That's the variable we decided to test, the change.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and now that you're reporting on the change, you have to be kind of specific, once again, on the wording that you understand that you are...
Okay. You are specific about change.
And change between the different intervention conditions. Change in symptoms between the different intervention conditions.
Yes.
Which is a bit kind of a long sentence, but still, I mean, it's a bit more precise.
Yes. Okay.
Reporting there. Okay, so then we have discussed about the impact of, or the possible impact of the control condition, the reference condition that you are using in
study three.
Yes.
It's difficult because it's not a proper comparison and the context is different, yes.
Okay, then if we go to the discussion section. Fortunately, you are saying clearly that the results in page 64.3, that the initial results of the three studies are promising, but must be interpreted cautiously to the limitations in the design. And then you mentioned different types of limitations there. Pages or in the pages to come, 69, for example, or 70. Now that you look at the list of limitations, would you add anything there?
Probably the design.
Okay.
The design could be one of the limitations, so yes, adding data points. would definitely help the analysis and make the results stronger.
Yes, that's good. Yes, for example, in the study 2 on page 69, we're really going to mention that one of the limitations would be that there's no follow-up there.
Yes, no follow-up. I'm also thinking what could be... I would definitely look for a proper measure of well-being as well. If we talk about well-being, not just the absence or the change in symptoms, but like a proper measure of well-being. Maybe even a different, and we have some of that for part of the sample, but not all of that. So that's why we cut it down on our analysis or like selected these variables. Investigate different processes of psychological flexibility and see if there is any difference in different processes compared to these. Another thing, I had it on the tip of my tongue.
I was hoping that in the study 1 you would mention as an limitation the cross-sectionality of the data.
Yes, cross-sectionality could be an over limitation. Yes.
So you have this possibility that actually applies to the study 2 also, in the change analysis, that there is this possibility that that there is this reverse of the temporal sequence.
Yeah, the temporal sequence, yeah.
That the symptoms of depression could affect the psychological
The psychological flexibility part, yes.
We don't really, based on the analysis as we discussed, we don't really know which way it goes. We have this theoretical background. Okay, and on related to study 3, I would have perhaps mentioned as an additional limitation that one of the interventions was delivered
during the context of the pandemic.
Pandemic, and the other one was after.
Yes, probably it was better to bring it up again, even in this section. Yes.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yes, definitely.
And I agree.
It would be important to list all,
to list all of the limitations. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, because, I mean,
it does change the efficacy for sure.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, you can get away with lots of limitations. I mean, we all have many limitations in our results. And research and designs, you can get away with all that if you just mention them in the discussion, in the limitations. But if you don't really mention them in the limitations,
I agree. It's mentioned in the discussion more generally, but it could be a point to bring up specific also in limitation.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. And also about the additional limitation concerning the study 3 on the differences in the intervention between the Zoom intervention and the face-to-face intervention.
The adjustment that were made.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
It might be often minor effects.
It could have affected also.
But I find that personally that it's better to mention
more than less. Okay. Yeah.
Because the reader, if he or she is careful, the reviewer, for example, they usually spot the limitations there.
Yeah, in the discussion in general, and then they ask to bring it up more specifically. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Well, anyways. Yes, but as mentioned earlier, I was really happy about the page 70, almost the last line text saying that fortunately you were not able to conclude on the causality of the effects.
Yes.
So I would have rephrased it in the sequence of the effect.
In the sequence of the effect. Okay.
Okay, right, then one other issue that I was kind of thinking of concerning your conclusions. Now that you kind of compare those who had all five sessions to those who mm-hmm. had
only three or four
sessions, and you didn't really find a difference there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the face-to-face intervention, yes.
Yes, in the face-to-face intervention, yeah.
No, but where not so much difference was the video conference group, yes.
Right, right.
Yes.
Okay. So that really kind of mean that the effect of these two different interventions were...
Yeah, the variables may have changed. So like variables that we were not able to control. Mm. I think the context affected that linearity. Because otherwise, I don't think we would have seen it as clearly in the face-to-face intervention.
Yeah.
So the pandemic context, at least in my opinion, may have affected part of that. Especially if I think about the specifics of the protocol. So the fifth meeting is usually like a well-rounded ending of the intervention. So we tend to bring up all of the processes. We tend to stress a lot about acceptance, a lot about self-compassion. So I think if people attended, you know, that too, it definitely has an impact. Because, for example, with the last review round that we had in the fourth article, it was argued, maybe if you use video conference, three or four sessions are enough. If you apply this protocol, I think the fifth meeting, in my opinion, is fundamental. Because it brings everything together and it really like relies on the acceptance part and self-compassion part a lot. So I don't think it's a problem of content. It was more a problem of context. So something during that time frame may have happened that influenced the efficacy, effectiveness of the intervention.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think that it might be challenging to, I mean, now that you're saying that it might be that three or four sessions might be enough.
Maybe enough. If you adjust the protocol.
Yeah, but I mean, if you add sessions, if you had not five, but you had six or seven sessions,
it could be, but then... Results? Yes, for sure.
So where is enough? What is enough?
That's what we are trying to find out.
Yes.
So, for example, we students... just four sessions...
Yes.
For sure, our research group has another small pilot study that uses one session, one group, one meeting overall to influence flexibility. Yes. And they have had good results.
Yes, exactly.
So it depends on what you want to do. Other type of protocols that have longer intervention, yes, they do have good results, but I think it can significantly implement dropout, especially in the student population. So if you do too long of an intervention, then it's difficult to retain students, to retain participants.
It's also about how you conclude here. I mean, if you would have had intervention of four sessions, mm-hmm. for example,
yeah,
instead of five, you would have had four sessions,
mm-hmm.
and then you had a data where you have two or three sessions. Mm-hmm. And then you would compare and say that there's no difference there.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have said that two or three would be enough? Or if you would have had three sessions intervention and you would have had two or one session and there's no difference between there, would you say that's maybe two or
it
one?
It is a possibility, but I think if you go briefer and briefer, then those differences get lower.
Yeah.
At least that's how I would expect it to work.
Just be careful how you phrase the mm-hmm. conclusions once again, because, I mean, now you're comparing two groups, five sessions, against mm-hmm. three or four.
Yes.
You have no idea what would have happened mm-hmm. if you had five or six or seven or eight or nine sessions.
Yeah.
Or if you had one or two or three sessions.
Right.
Or one or two sessions.
Yeah.
So,
another point that we can bring up in the best case scenario of like doing another type of intervention, adding a middle point of data collection. That's probably one change that I would implement. So you can maybe see if there's a difference, like if you already have good effectiveness in the middle point, and how much does that change towards the end?
Okay. Anyways, I think this is a very, very difficult topic to study. Yeah. That how much is enough?
Yeah.
You can always have a bit more effect if you have add more, and you have a little bit less
yes.
effect if you have to take out some of the sessions. And eventually you were talking about the differences or not existing differences between comparison from,
yes.
in your case, from 5 to 3 or 4.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is kind of enough for would it
or, yeah,
have
yeah,
been
yeah,
more
yeah.
if
yeah.
had more and what is kind of enough.
Yes.
What's the
yes.
The optimal outcome of the intervention.
Mm-hmm.
We don't
know, no. We are not able to tell at this moment. And our group has been researching that for several years. So there's still a lot to know.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure that at some point there is a kind of a plateau that if you just add sessions, it will kind of plateau at some point.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Whether it's really between 5 and 3 or 4.
Yeah, yeah. Probably it's not that much in that point. But it was a difference that we noticed, and then we thought, okay, this is an interesting point, like, what happened here? And we thought about, brought it up, because it opens up different questions. I remember, especially when I was, like, researching video conference intervention, there was an intervention that had 12 sessions, and in that case, they had quite large dropping out. The other one that were 6 or 8 were still good in terms of dropout. So it's not the video conference condition that influenced dropouts. The length may have an influence on that. But of course, there's not enough research to back up that statement.
Right. Okay. Good. All right. Just a few comments on the reference list. You have an excellent choice of book. References and lots of them. So obviously you have very kind of well done your background work on getting to know the literature, which is obviously a very important point and nice to notice. There are in the references there are some beauty spots there, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I don't know if you used some reference manager. Program or
several,
okay, but there are in quite many cases it seems like the journal name was missing there, so I was kind of hoping it just happened to notice that because there were some references that I was interested in, and then I was looking for the journal, let's say Gen 2022 as an example, but there are many others also.
Mm-hmm.
Where and these come from just normal journal articles. But it doesn't say which journal. And it seems like it's just disappeared. And I was kind of thinking, as there were quite many of these cases, I was thinking that maybe it's just a problem of this.
It could be
manager.
A problem of the reference management. I had problem with Mendeley before. And that's why I also use another one.
Right.
And then we also use reviewers. So
one additional lesson to learn, that never trust completely
the AI. Yeah, I agree.
You have to check.
I cannot tell how many times I looked at this list, but still always something comes up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yes, there are rather many of those that kind of
Okay. Okay, I will have a proper look for sure.
When you import the references from some source, maybe it's just
Yep.
So be careful with that. Also. But I think at this point, I am satisfied, I am happy, and it's been very pleasurable to discuss with your work today. It's been also a learning experience for me.
And for me as well, yeah.
So it's been very, very nice to have this possibility to get to know your work, and especially now that it is such an important part of research also. And it's been, as I've said a couple of times, it's been very nice to know this, that you are well aware of the research that has taken place in this particular field. And I am happy to recommend the acceptance of your thesis to the Faculty of Education and Psychology at the University of Jyväskylä. So my part, I think this is done.
Thank you.
Okay, the public examination has been concluded.
So, do we still have to do?
Maybe we remember.
Yeah, we forgot about one thing. Yes. So, if anyone here has any critical comments to make on my dissertation, please ask the Kostas for the floor.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
So we are ready.
So for anyone who wants to join, we have coffee and refreshments outside. Thank you.
Thank you.